I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, Raghu, and I'm back with my old friend Ralph De La Rosa. Ralph, how you doing?
I'm very well, my friend. It's great to be here with you. How are you?
Oh, getting along. You know, we were just talking about it, but and I was thinking, whenever you say that to somebody and they say, yeah, we're doing the best we can now, or just we're hanging in there.
Mm-hmm. How are you is a loaded question these days.
Yeah, nobody can go into it. I mean, because every part of all of our lives has been disrupted in some way, which is just as a good segue to. So Ralph has this book, came out last year, right, Ralph, at the end of the year?
Yeah, late last year, yeah.
Yeah, Don't Tell Me to Relax. When I saw this, I thought, okay, this is perfect for me, because I'm like, don't tell me to relax. God damn it. And then, of course, the subtitle, Emotional Resilience in the Age of Rage, Feels and Freakouts. So that's how we're all doing. We're doing the best we can with everything that's going on. Seemed to have gotten a little bit better earlier this year, and a little more stable politically and so on. And we're still dealing with the pandemic, and we're still dealing with this racial justice. I mean, it's extraordinary. And the freakout, talk about freakouts, where we're seeing so many shootings in our country on, seems like almost day to day, but certainly week to week. I wouldn't be exaggerating there. So, yeah, all of this is well needed. And Ralph, I love the way, Ralph, that you put it together and express it in ways that can communicate to anybody. You do not have to be a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Nethin. You just got to be someone who goes, wow, I really would like to shift my perspective the way it is possible for us to do. And it means a lot. But meanwhile, catching up, because I know you're in Nevada now. And yeah, how is life on the western side?
It's gorgeous over here. Yeah, I'm actually on the California side of Lake Tahoe currently. And I've been Just working away, I decided this was my spot for the COVID year. And so I've just been here in the Tahoe National Forest. And I open up my laptop and I see my therapy clients. I see my meditation students. I get to hang out with folks like you. And then I close the laptop and I go back to the forest. And I've been doing a tremendous amount of snowboarding and different athletic training to kind of offset and to work with a lot of the stress and the emotions and what have you, and kind of keep life in a balanced place. Yeah. It's one thing to walk through this pandemic. It's another thing to walk through this pandemic with a very fiery aspiration to be of service to others and to hold space for others and to really kind of be in the thick of things with folks. It requires a tremendous amount of counterbalancing in terms of self-care and being able to regulate and what have you. So,
boy, you're in the right spot, but we all are. There's always a park nearby with a couple of trees at least. And we've been talking, I have been with different people on the podcast and just hanging out about the value of connecting in that way through nature to really counterbalance the stress that we have been under. And you picked the right spot. And I'm in the middle of a bunch of orange and avocado orchards that I walk through. That does the trick, that's for sure. And I know lots of people are doing it, and I certainly would encourage anybody listening, that is a primary way of rebuilding resources. And Ralph is going to talk about it a little bit today, resilience and rebuilding resources and so on. And for those of you who have not heard any of Ralph and I have done a couple of these things over the last few years, and Ralph's story really enables him to speak to the truth of the possibility of growing resilience and moving into a different perspective rather than and just briefly, I mean, you go into it a little again in this book, particularly, I mean, that hit me, the high school thing. That is such a tough thing when you are not part of the gang or the clique, and your life seems to be, you're in deep questioning of the reality of your life and who you are, which is for you then, and it was me as well. I remember back then that I spent real time on it. I'm thankful to actually music was such a huge thing for me when I was growing up as a teenager, and the kind of people I gravitated towards had something really special that allowed me to embrace that possibility of moving out of my little me land. And belief in my story and all of it. So, yeah, talk a little bit just about your high school experience and how it's informed you later in life here.
Yeah, well, I mean, the trouble really began for me before high school. I developed a pretty severe depression at the age of 8 years old and experienced, you know, abandonment of my dad and all kinds of rough experiences with him, which I talk about some in the book. Some of the visits to see him in Oklahoma were very, very abusive. And by the time I got to high school, I was just kind of a mess. I had fairly active PTSD that was just sort of out in the open. I didn't really, I wasn't able to sweep it under the rug so much. And I was just one of these kids that was really dejected and really sad a lot and very frustrated and really didn't see the point of the world. Mantra that went through my head at that time constantly was, why would anybody bring a kid into this world? You know, and then to, you know, not show up for them and, you know, all the other things that went on in childhood. Why would anybody do that? I don't want to be here. I didn't ask to be here. And I very much wanted out. And I think that that is actually the kind of birthplace of spirituality for a lot of us, right? Is like we feel cornered, we feel trapped, we feel stuck, and we want a way out. You know, and spirituality doesn't actually give us so much of a way out. It's kind of a trick. there's a bait and switch. We think it's a way out, but yeah, it's a way to go deeper. Mm. And then that going deeper ends up being a liberatory sort of thing. But yeah, bullied, attacked viciously with weapons. I won't go too into details here, but on many occasions, to the point that I'm a high school dropout. I dropped out the moment I was legally able to on my own, and finished up my diploma in an independent study, which was basically like sixth grade level stuff. And and so it goes. I mean, and then spit out into the world with all of this baggage and all of this confusion and all of this longing and loneliness and you know, and no education and what to do with that. And eventually that gave way to drugs. And I mean, a great time with drugs, honestly, in the beginning. So it goes, you know, that's kind of the trajectory. In the beginning it works, and then you get to a point where it stops working and it becomes a hellscape. And you can't get out of that. Mm. And just on down the snake pit. And you know, I was fortunate in that I met with some really beautiful conditions and some really beautiful teachers. The Vaishnava Hare Krishna tradition became a thing in my life. Amma and Amma's Darshan, the hugging saint, if you haven't heard of her, you can look her up, became a thing in my life. And that really, even though it wasn't the trauma work that I needed so desperately and didn't know that I needed yet, it gave me a very rich and beautiful context and a sense of possibility that as I wound my way down to kind of the bottom of the pit, to the hard rock bottom, we'll say, of heroin addiction, and then discovering mindfulness and Buddhist meditation as I was beginning to clean up my act and get therapy and get medication for my depression and what have you, having that devotional background really, really came into play in terms of understanding meditation and understanding what's possible for this human life, you know? And if I can just say quickly, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people are struggling right now, and we're in this kind of next chapter of the COVID thing, and we're still deep in the pit with injustices and addressing systemic oppression. But the point I want to tease out here is despite the calamity and the disaster, it's possible to awaken in these conditions. It's possible to utilize the difficulty, not try to escape it or go around it, but to actually to go again deeper with it in such a way, if we can meet it in the right way and apply ourselves in the right way, it becomes possible to turn this into an opportunity to wake up and to develop the heart of compassion, really.
Yeah, that's, I think I mentioned it last time, Ralph. The Chinese would call this dangerous opportunity.
Yeah. But I think about, I've been referring back a lot to Viktor Frankl, actually, this year.
I marked out that quote in the book from him. I mean, I spoke of you as someone who has been through the quote-unquote wars from a young age, and and speaks, and you have the authority to speak from a place of where there is possibility, and this is not BS. Well, Viktor Frankl, I mean, you know, he was in the camps, and of course, just I'm trying to look for this thing. I don't know if you have it, but it's something we got to. Viktor Frankl was in the concentration camp.
Yeah.
And wrote this book that's just phenomenal. Yeah. But this gives you an idea. And we've quoted him, and I have in other podcasts, often.
Yeah.
Because, again, he speaks from the kind of experience that very few people have had, and is able to convey that the reality of even in the most uncertain and oppressive circumstances, there is an opportunity. There always is an opportunity.
Yeah.
So he just, here's his quote, "Everything can be taken from a person, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way, to choose one's attitude." And to me, that means a perspective. And just, it's amazing how small a shift it is as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he woke up to that penetrating insight after walking out of Auschwitz. And so what does that have to say, you know, for us in our situations where it feels so fraught, it feels so complex, it feels so impossible so much of the time? How are we going to get through this? How are we going to make sense of this? You know, now a big thing with folks is, how are we going to walk back into life? Like, what do we do in this transitional moment where there's still so many unknowns and there's the prevalence of newfound social anxiety for folks? There's, I truly believe in my bones that we are going to see a wave of PTSD and trauma. Like, it's going to start catching up to us over the course of the next, you know, year, 3-5 years. People are going to really start feeling the effects of what they've been through and have to process it. Still in the age of freakouts.
You know, so the very first page of the book, you have this phenomenal quote that I've never heard before from Joseph Campbell. If you're falling, dive. that's so great, you know, encompasses everything around what real surrender is, not the kind that we think of in the West. In India, it's called Sharanagat, which is the kind of, it's the kind of last thing in terms of waking up, is this surrender that's not surrender. It's beyond surrender. It's where there's no choice left. It's completely choiceless, letting go and diving. Letting go and diving. And then your other, that quote from the Vedas, samsara davanala nadalida loka, being caught up in this world is like sleeping in a forest fire. I never knew that one either. I love that. By the way, when did you go to India? And you were doing a whole monastic thing, didn't you?
I did a whole monastic thing in Pacific Beach, California.
Okay, that's not so monastic-y. Come on.
But, you know, the robes and the tilak and the mangalartis and the, you know, and the 16 rounds every morning of japa and
this is thing. As you came out of the whole more desperate situation, shall we say?
It was actually a pit stop in the middle of the desperate situation.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, one of my first very half-assed attempts at finding my way out was, well, let's move into an ashram, right? Isn't that a fantasy that so many people have? I'll just move into a monastery and then everything will be fine. And then you move into the monastery and what you find out is that your trauma finds you there.
Seems too right. Anywhere you go,
and then you have actually less places to hide, and there's, you know, more work to do and more personalities around you, and you know, and the discipline, the tapas of the whole thing, you know, the fiery discipline of the whole thing brings it right out. And
just thinking of, you know, all of the, As you say and talk about, you know, all of the troubles and the suffering and the disasters and all of it can be, as you put it, a wellspring of inspiration. So now people get angry when you say stuff like that. You know, I mean, Ram Dass used to say, suffering brings him great joy. It allows him to get one with God and something like that. And, but, you know, people, to get into, because people can get into this, you know, that kind of concept in a very masochistic way, in a very, it's completely, has nothing to do with the inherent message that everything is open and possible. Again, if you just shift your perspective a little bit, these things can, and a lot of people go back, wow, if that thing hadn't happened to me then, I never would have blah, blah, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, how many stories of cancer survivors or folks, you know, who even died of AIDS are out there, you know, who there's some cases where people are, this is horrible. This is the worst thing that ever happened to me. It's so traumatic. And there are many stories out there of people who say this, I didn't appreciate life until this horrible thing happened to me. I didn't appreciate time. I didn't appreciate people until I, you know, got a real taste of how limited of a window we have to be in this body and to absorb the preciousness of this life, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, Ram Dass also said this other thing that I've been coming back to over and over again, that the awakened ones, the enlightened beings, they still have their neuroses, but their neuroses are just irrelevant to them. They're just, you know, they still have their anger and their hangups, and but it's just kind of off to the side, and what's front and center is the heart.
Well, there's no more hooks and stuff. There's no nothing. The attachment, all of it is gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's different levels of that. I think, yeah, I remember him saying that too in a talk. Yeah, 'cause what he said actually at some point. Yeah, all of that stuff. Well, what's happened over the years? They didn't go anywhere. I still got all that stuff, but they're more like little schmooze now. You know, they're not. So good.
Yeah.
Now there's something here that I have to get edification on, Ralph.
Hit me.
'Cause
this just got interesting.
Kirtan. Now you talked about kirtan. And you've had all that, you know, some good experience with the Hare Krishna mantra.
Yeah. Yeah. Ama as well.
And and Ama, who has wonderful kirtan.
Yeah.
So I guess you're speaking of a specific devotional hymn, but okay, that's bhajan, but kirtan, repeating God's names to music and rhythm, goes on to speak of an ocean of mercy that is capable of extinguishing the heat of the suffering world, which is a core thing around Maha Mantra, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. And it's a little unfortunate that they say this is the only way, and if you don't do this, you're out. It's a little fundamentalist, but, you know, it's funny because I went to a Hare Krishna convocation, I've told this before, and with a friend, and it was like all day, all night, Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. Big hall with all different singers. And I remember this one guy who I still listen to today. He's, by the way, everybody, his name is Madhava Prabhu. You can, he's on Instagram and he does these. He has the most effective heart opening melodies for this mantra that I have heard in a long time. And he does these live things. You go to his page, you'll find some of these live things. Anyhow, he started singing. And I just, so it was hours of complete letting go of everything. And at the end of it, I said to my friend, maybe they're right. You just need to do that mantra. In fact, maybe I'll go get that little haircut they do, you know, with the little thing on the. But you say it tells us that such a boon could only be delivered through the strength of intelligent self-inquiry combined with courageous, compassionate action. Okay, so what are we talking about here in terms of the, really we're talking bhakti, right? The merging of subject object through Maha Mantra is the most intellectual way I could put that, alongside of intelligent self inquiry. How are you moving those things around?
Well, what I offered is an interpretation of this bhajan, of this this song that we sang every morning at 4:30 a.m. after a cold shower.
Oh, that was a monastic scene by the beach in California.
Yeah, the literal translation probably goes something like devotion to the guru, devotion to Krishna, you know, is the way to reach the ocean of mercy. But if you think about what that means from a less dualistic, less a personal view of God or divinity, and you apply it to, you know, here we are in this view, you know, the view I hold is Krishna's in everybody. Krishna's in everything. Krishna's in every cell of my body. Krishna's in the trees outside. Krishna's in the person that I'm trying to help or serve in some way, you know. And what is mantra if not intelligent self-inquiry? It's you're working on yourself, but in a specific way. You're relating to the vibration of the mantra, and things are coming up. I mean, emotions are coming up, thoughts are coming up, your kleshas and samskaras, your habits and your unwanted sufferings are all coming out. And, you know, bhakti isn't, I do think it's unfortunate that the Vaishnavas feel they have the one true way. I think they have a really beautiful way. And it's one of many ways. But it all comes down to compassion. It all comes down to love. You know, there's a million things that will work. There's a million things that can liberate us, but they all have one thing in common, and that's compassion. That's love. And yeah. So that's the idea that I'm infusing into that interpretation, is that through self-inquiry, through working with yourself, and through applying the compassionate heart in your life, your relationships, and all the situations that unfold, that opens an ocean of mercy where you become resilient. You can, you know, as Charles Bukowski says, what matters most is how you walk through the fire. You can walk through the fire. You can absorb the insanity that's going on around us and inside of us all the time. We can do it, but we need a method. We need a path. You know,
yeah.
You can't just do it bare naked or while half asleep.
Yeah. You know? Right. Either or. I feel very fortunate that what ever caught me, because there's no real idea of what that thing is, through what Ram Dass, when I first met him, and then particularly, of course, Neem Karoli Baba. But what came out over the years, and it manifested itself in when Ram Dass was still alive, and he was in Maui. And we do these retreats there. Somehow, all these retreats had Buddhist participants, presenters, people like Jack Kornfield and so on.
Yeah, and Sharon. Yeah.
And Sharon and Joseph and Roshi Halifax. You know, really great, great teachers of that tradition, of Buddhist traditions, different ones. And they were just, Ram Dass, as far as he was concerned, he never gave it a thought. He'd have fun with them a little bit whenever they talk about soul or... and look over at them and go, you know, and jive them, or they jive him. Yeah. But he never thought of it. They were old friends, you know, friends that we collectively known for a long, long time. But then if we started to, there was some edification of what it was, and that it was about pretty much what you're spelling out here and what we're talking about right now, which is the use of a heart-opening practice, bhakti, mm-hmm. through music, sound, and vibration mm-hmm. of mantra, and alongside of that, discriminating wisdom, particularly mm-hmm. through the Buddhist tradition. And that seemed to be a combo that we were given. And I'm, that's why I say, geez, I'm really, I now think about it and go, this is a wonderful combination of practices that we've been part of without realizing. Although Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba used to, he didn't talk a lot about other gurus or teachers or anything, but that when it came around to the Tibetans, he was particularly praising of them. And yeah, I remember, because people were seeing like Kalu Rinpoche, I don't know if somebody mm-hmm. from back then, who was an extraordinary lama, and of course the 16th Karmapa, and so that just forgetting about the specific traditions, the idea of discriminating wisdom and self-inquiry and mindfulness, you just described it all alongside of the to me, the tough thing, which is opening up into that love and compassion, because mm-hmm. we all have a hard time with doing it for ourselves, right? And I'm sure you talk about that, because I'm sure you talk a lot about that to people.
Yeah. Here's the thing, is I don't think it's hard. I don't think it's hard. It just takes some practice. It takes some help, and usually some one-on-one help. But I also work with a modality called internal family systems, which is incredibly aligned with Buddhism and Tibetan, Tantric Buddhism in particular. That's a form of psychotherapy that I practice. And one of the central processes that we do called parts work entails finding compassion for the parts of your mind that are afflicted, such as with anger or loneliness or whatever. And there's a particular way that we engage folks to at least get curious. If you can start getting curious about, okay, this anger is coming up, it's flooding my body. Now, all of a sudden, my mind is saying all of these things that it normally wouldn't say, like, I want to kill that MF, you know, or whatever. You know, isn't that so curious? Isn't that like a fascinating aspect of your human experience? Actually, if you take a step back from it and look at it, doesn't it become possible to say, what really is going on with all this energy that's coming up? And what we find is that, you know, our defensive emotional parts, such as our angry parts, are always protecting a more vulnerable aspect of our psyche. And then when you tap into the vulnerable parts of your psyche, well, those are like little children, aren't they? Wanting, you know, maybe wanting mom and dad, maybe wanting just to be held. And if you can really, really step into a perception of like, this, you know, vulnerable or wounded inner child part of me is really a living presence inside, which our emotions are alive, our bodies are alive, our breath is alive. And it starts to make sense to soften in the presence of your own emotional being. But if I can take this to kind of a different place, this is a slight sidebar. We can also begin to glimpse that all of those emotional states, such as, let's take anger, and I talk about this a great deal in Don't Tell Me to Relax. If you think about anger for a moment, anger actually has compassion at its core. The very spark that gives rise to anger is compassion itself. Because what is anger if not an energy that sees injustice or insult or injury and dares to respond in a fiery way, in a big way.
But how does that come from compassion? I'm not getting that.
Well, the definition of compassion is you see suffering and you want to address it. It's the quivering of the heart that wants to address suffering. And even though I'm not saying the expression of anger, I'm saying at its very root, there's a compassionate intent there. And then the way that we experience anger, of course, you know, it's by the time it reaches the conscious mind, and we have the experience of being angry, it's already gone through so many layers, so many filters of our, you know, from the unconscious up to the conscious. And we get something that is much more afflicted. But it still remains true that anger is an energy that sees some form of suffering and is attempting to address it, is responding to it in some way. And that's...
I'm trying to get there. Because, you know, we've talked about this before. Anger, certainly. I mean, most of us are dealing with anger issues.
Well, we have the example of Ma Kali in the, you know, Vedic pantheon of gods and goddesses, right? She's pissed. Blood dripping from her tongue, skulls hanging around her neck, eight arms, most of them holding weapons. She's on a rampage, but she's on a holy rampage. Because she, you know, it's very similar to the case of, you know, the last guy that we had in the presidential office, right? Like that she was born out of all of the gods' urgent need to address this demon who was taking over the universe and became way too powerful. This is this tyrant demon. And so the gods and goddesses, you know, that's the origin. Well, one of the many origin stories of Mother Kali. But, you know, they all got together and said, what are we going to do about this guy? We got to get him out of here. And they shot, you know, the energy of their anger and concern out of their third eyes. And all of their third eye energy beamed into giving birth to this beautiful and horrific super angry goddess, but her one and only mission was to destroy ignorance.
Mm-hmm. And that's the compassion.
Yeah.
Well, this is again part of what we were talking about before, shifting of view, perspective.
Yeah.
It's to encompass just even like me right now allowing that, because whenever I express anger, it becomes so one-dimensional and so piled on from so many different sources. So there's blindness. I mean, obviously, much less these days than it was, you know, decades ago. But still, as you can hear, I was like, compassion? What are you talking about? You know?
But see, what you're describing right there is the habitual way we normally mm-hmm. experience anger, which is an intoxication. It's a form of intoxication.
Yeah.
Right. But it's also possible to pause and to just, you know, it's the hardest thing in the world sometimes to do, but to just stop and notice that you're angry and notice that you're angry because something happened. And, you know, you're angry because you want to address whatever insult or horrible thing came your way. And from there, you know, and this is that intelligent process of self-inquiry. You know, once you stop and you breathe and you stand back from your anger a little bit, as opposed to the one-way road that most of us go down, which is always leads us to regrets and apologies later. You know, we then, you know, forks in the road open up and we can start making different choices.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. The intoxication of power that anger presents is, I'm just thinking now, it pushes away the possibility of compassionate action.
Yeah.
And that's again that switch of perspective in that moment. By the way, you were talking about when we all have like suddenly the weirdest ass thoughts and dark thoughts that you could ever have, and the curiosity. I think that's an important thing. And just this little story Ram Dass told us. I think it's common knowledge, but. When Aldous Huxley was dying. He was taking acid every day. Ram Dass was quite close to his wife. And it got to the point where everything he looked out at, everything that he encountered, the only response that came out of him at this point was, with his British accent, which I can't really do well, extraordinary, extraordinary, extraordinary. There's a good mantra, right, for us. I was thinking about that when you started talking about, you know, encountering this darkness and of thoughts and so on, and being able to just again pause for a minute and be curious about, well, what the Ram Dass's thing, by the way, was, wow, how did I get here? He'd have a dark thought, you know. How did I get here? But I like extraordinary. Wow.
Yeah.
And all of these things do the thing you're talking about, pause. And that is the biggest thing that happens over time. Once you start to let go a little bit of the belief in the thoughts and the stories, and that is, there's a gap and you're not jumping into wanting to beat the living shit out of the driver next to you that just cut you off. You're not jumping in feeling wronged and feeling righteous, which is one of the most difficult, probably the most difficult. I am right. You are harming me, you know?
So. Yeah. But this is where meditation comes in. Because meditation is,
you have a whole chapter about that.
Oh,
it's funny. What did you call that?
Oh, about that meditation practice you're kind of sort of maybe sometimes doing.
I love that.
Yeah. But I mean, it's such an ideal training ground for how we respond, because everything that the world is throwing at us, our own minds is, you know, will throw at us too. If we clear the space and we sit down, there's our anxiety, there's our self-hatred, you know, there's all the things we experience in the world. And so we get to practice, though, in that controlled environment. How do I respond? How do I calibrate to the heart in the face of this? It's really what I think meditation is, a big part of what it's for is I have a friend, Dr. Miles Neal, who wrote the book Gradual Awakening.
Yes, I know him. Yeah. Wonderful guy.
He calls the meditation your flight simulator for life.
That meditation should be approached, in my mind, along the same lines as you approach teeth brushing your teeth. You never think about it. You get up in the morning, aside from going to the bathroom, the first thing you do is brush your teeth, most people.
Yep.
And there's not a thought, geez, I got to go brush my teeth, you know? So meditation, once you give up thinking about it, you just sit there. You know, it doesn't matter what happens. The fact that you're sitting there is enough. You know, it's enough.
It's true.
Yeah.
The habit itself of sitting down with yourself makes so much more possible, no matter what's going down. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So emotional resilience, which, you know, we've been talking about, and certainly talking about anger and so on. And you do talk about basically, again, it's being in a view, you know, consumed by them and pushing them away or indulging them or repressing, which is what most of us do on a day to day. And talk about the idea that we treat them as you put it, one dimensional objects, as if they're not living embodied forces inside of us that have inherent value and intelligence. Talk about that. I think that's important.
Yeah. Well, subconsciously, we tend to objectify everything. Everything. We've made an object out of the earth, and our behavior towards the planet is evidence of that. We've made an object, we make objects out of each other all the time, which allows us to be enact aggression, enact, you know, all kinds of atrocities, you know, to, you know, in war, they reduce the enemy to, you know, the level of an animal, to objectify them, to make it psychologically possible to kill, maim, destroy. And we do that internally. You know, we treat the body as a machine, which the body is, you know, 13.5 trillion cells. And each of those cells is in communication with their neighbor, has a function, has, you know, we could say in a sense, has an awareness of their function. You know, the body is very much, my teacher says the body is a living other. The body is a living other, and we ought to treat it as such and communicate with it as such. And it's definitely communicating with us all the time. It's giving us so much data and information. And the same is true of, you know, our breath and our thoughts. They're living energies that are, they're an expression of our vitality, really. And that's also true of our emotions, that they are living forces in our lives. They are often the centerpiece of all of our decision making, actually, no matter how rational we take ourselves to be. And they always have a reason. They always have a reason for coming up, for arising. And they contain a lot of information, actually. So we're very quick to say, I don't want to feel lonely, so I turn on Netflix or whatever my habit du jour is. But actually, that loneliness is coming from somewhere. It's coming from perhaps an experience in childhood, perhaps an experience in the present moment, perhaps both combined, usually both combined. And it's nagging at you. It's eating at you, really, because that's a part of you that wants your attention. That's why our emotions are intense, is they want our attention. And it, when we, instead of turning on the Netflix or whatever, when we stop and we turn and say, okay, what is it that you want me to know? You know, our lonely parts or our sad parts or things start happening inside of us. We can absolutely communicate within our own psyche. It's not an inner monologue. It's an inner dialogue at all times, usually more like a rioting crowd. But
judge and jury.
But in this way, you know, our emotions are trying to get our attention. There's a story that perhaps needs to be told. There's insight that we can begin to unpack when we turn within, when we stop objectifying our emotions and we start treating them as living presences in our lives. And the big thing is that when you do that, it opens the doorway to, in all eventuality, resolving the very source of, you know, why does loneliness keep coming? Why does anxiety keep coming around? No matter what I do, I find that, you know, I'm always in the situation that pisses me off in the same way again, where every lever I take reminds me of the last one, no matter how hard I try to pick a different one or whatever, you know, where we are on these treadmills of experiences, and we take it as, you know, this means life sucks, or this means, you know, this always happens to me because I was born to lose, or but it's actually that these situations are eating at us because they want our attention. And when we stop and give our attention, it's healing becomes possible, moving forward becomes possible, understanding, you know, going back to the very source. For me, the source of my persistent loneliness is abandonment that I had in experienced in childhood. But through processes like what I'm talking about here, I've been able to go back and hold space for those inner child parts that I found inside that were stuck waiting for mom to come home, waiting for dad to finally be kind to me for the first time, waiting for an apology of some sort. And I've been able to say to those child parts of me, I got you now. Mom and dad are gone. We're grown now. And I'm going to hold you, and I'm going to love you, and I'm going to just stay here with this loneliness you feel until it's all gone, until every last drop of it is gone. And this funny thing happens when you do that. If you stay long enough, the loneliness runs out. That part of you has a chance to what we call unburden themselves of whatever the affliction is.
That's the beginning of the compassion and love for oneself before you can even think of sharing that.
I think that that's the beginning of enlightenment, to be honest with you.
I agree.
I think enlightenment's a reductive process. It's a lightening of our load. And it's the enlightened state is what we're left with when there's no more affliction and running around in ignorance and confusion in the inner system. But maybe you want to debate me on that point. I think some would.
No. I mean, and you know, it's part of my own little philosophical bent, which is enlightenment. No enlightenment if you saw it. None of us would. Are you out of your mind? How about being kind and loving and compassionate to others? Let's get there. And that's what you just described is a way to open to that by virtue of starting with oneself. So I totally am in agreement there.
Thank you. Yeah. They say if someone were enlightened, they'd be too busy helping others to notice.
You got so many great little things in here to help shift out of this, the attachment that we have to the habitual patterns and neurotic tendencies, which are so, and I think one thing that, I love was this, your little, chapter around shifting the inner dialogue, because boy, are we horrible. The way we talk to ourselves is beyond you. People won't even share that, even with their closest people, about how one talks to oneself. It's extraordinary, and it's demeaning. It's so full of judgment, and I mean, it's extraordinary. And of course, mindfulness and a little meditation. By the way, meditation doesn't have to be, if you just sit there, yes, you can do wonderful. There's a gazillion different kinds of meditation. And the one that I have loved over the years and learned back in the day is insight meditation. I think that's a very, so anybody looking for that, I'm sure the people who are doing the show notes will give you a link over to Sharon and Joseph and Jack and the teachings that they have brought back.
Solid method.
Yeah. But it can be chanting. It can be body movement. It can be just walking around, meet Ralph out in the woods there where he is. It does not matter. That's the point. Yeah. It does not matter. So, but shifting that inner dialogue. Yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, well, I feel like we've really been, right? Because we can talk about this in at least two ways, and then probably a gazillion ways, as you said, just as with forms of meditation. You know, stopping, turning around, and looking at the source of where those thoughts are coming from, where that voice is coming from, and getting curious about what's going on that. There's a part of me that would be so harsh, so incriminating, so mean, so nasty. That's one way. But, you know, one of the things I love about mindfulness practice is it kind of happens implicitly as you continue with it, where, you know, the common experience is you're there at the tip of your nose, you're paying attention to the breath. My mind comes in, thought comes in, and it's a real juicy one. It's, you know, all the things I got to take care of when I get up from the cushion. And we go headlong into that thought stream. And then somehow, some way, we remember, oh, wait, shit, I'm meditating. And we come back to the breath. Well, where did that whole world of thought go? You know, it just felt so real. It just felt so important. And then it vanishes in a second. And this shows us something about the nature of mind and thoughts and this inner dialogue, that it's not real. It's fluff. Or as the Tibetans say, more like wind, less like rock. And so I've been actually talking to folks about treating their thoughts like, you know, when you are walking down the street and you see, maybe it's a busy street, but you see somebody you know walking towards you and you want to get their attention, but there's like three groups of people between you, and you just kind of look past those whoever's between you to grab the eye contact of your friend, and you project your voice past those folks, you know, and say hello, right? Just like that. If you treat your thoughts like they're the three people between you and your friend, that you just simply look past. You don't have to take everything that flows through your mind seriously. It's not as substantial as it seems in the moment. Hmm.
You know? Yep, they're just thoughts. They're not anything. They're a passing show. We had, when we were in India back in that day, they had cigarettes called passing show. So we used to buy them, cut off the front of them, and put it on our altars. Passing show. Isn't that great? Only in India.
Well, I mean, it's like women with postpartum depression or even postpartum psychosis, which, by the way, is far more prevalent than we think that it is. It is very, very common for women who have just had a baby to, say, walk by their microwave and have the passing show of, I'm going to put this thing in the microwave and turn it on. That's actually real. The one in four women will have that sort of experience in the postnatal moments. And the difference between somebody who goes into depression with that and or maybe even a psychosis with that, and somebody who just is able to carry on and get through that, is how seriously you take those thoughts. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the railroad switch that determines where the train is going. Because it's normal to have just all kinds of fluff passing through your mind. But if you hook into it, you believe it, and you take it as, oh God, I'm thinking about putting my baby in the microwave. then you know, the outcome is so different. And this isn't to blame any given woman in this circumstance. Is very, very difficult. But you know, one in four women suffer from postpartum depression, and one in 10 of those will develop postpartum psychosis. And this is a very, very common experience for these kinds of thoughts to come up. And what's important, though, is how you regard them.
Hmm. How about this, Ralph? Since I'm sitting on the couch right now, lying on the couch.
That'll cost you extra. If you want the therapy, just let me know where to invoice you.
Yes, no problem. No problem. but as you said that, the whole thing, that thought of the baby and mom and what she's going through. Mm-hmm. I had a baby that I was taking care of. My baby wife was gone, you know, mm-hmm. It was ours. This kid would not stop crying. I'm walking back and forth and back and forth. And then I went into another room and I'm carrying him in my arms. And so as you go through the actual door, and then there's the door jam, and head was a little, I had that thought. I'm going to bang that head on that door. If you don't stop, you know, oh my God. How? Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Holy
yeah.
Shit. I mean, the way in which I believed I'm bad. Oh my God. I am the worst human being that ever lived on, you know, going through all of that stuff that we all go through. And now I look back at that and yeah, I mean the level of self-involvement and taking every thought seriously, taking myself seriously, believing in all of it. What we do is extraordinary, really. And just a little, again, we're talking about that little shift of perspective, view, whatever. Mm-hmm. It means so much. Just if you just flip a little into not taking yourself seriously, these thoughts and the patterns that you have and so on, huh? And it's unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, I work with a tremendous amount of new parents who have experiences like this, you know, the rage, the the resentment, sometimes the jealousy, or, you know, I mean, new parenthood seems to be a real death and rebirth process for the parent to let go of their old life and step into the new one. And it can be, so much can come up. But I'll tell you something, every time I work with a parent in that situation and we look at those emotions and we follow the breadcrumb trail to what they're really about, we find their own childhood, their own upbringing somewhere in there. And it can be a very fruitful journey if you have good support.
One thing that to me, and if we're talking about antidotes to these kinds of things, the way that we're attached to our minds and so on, is, and you talk about this, is focusing on, the focus on ourselves is so tremendous. I mean, my friend Krishnadas, he calls it, you wake up in the morning to the movie of me. You're the director, producer, you're the lead actor, you're the writer, you got it all going 24/7, right? And we do.
Yeah.
We absolutely do. And and you do give a suggestion here, which I'm wholeheartedly support and believe in, that it's an extraordinary way to counter that exact, what do the Buddhists call it? Self-cherishing. Me, you know, is loving kindness. And Ram Dass coined it loving awareness, which shifting perspective. That's why loving kindness is a beautiful metta, it's called, a meditation. And Sharon Salzberg, by the way, you can get over to Sharon and site, and she's got wonderful meditations around loving kindness. Because what it does is it stops that self-absorption immediately in its tracks, because it's you're projecting outside yourself to other people, starting with people you do love and are easy to send blessings to, send love to, compassion, whatever, all the way to enemies and or people that you find are major, shall we say, wrongdoers in this life. And offering thoughts of well-being is an absolute primary way to stop that self-absorption and that focus on oneself. So I'm glad you brought that up. And
And it's a great way to feel better. Because as social beings who evolved to cooperate, which is why we have eyes in the front of our head and not on the sides, like a lot of other species, right? We're meant to have somebody watching our back, you know? We're hardwired to feel better when we're generous, when we cooperate, when we are collaborative, when we are in community with folks. We're hardwired. It's got to be from within. It can't just be a superficial thing. And that's the point of metta, maitri, loving kindness meditation, is to train in doing it from within, actually giving from the heart. And we're always the first one to cheer up in that when we do that. So,
Then you bring up a major point, a good way to close this session.
Sure.
And it's around us doing it together, whatever we've been talking about here, all this wonderful book, Don't Tell Me to Relax. I love that. I have to do that. But it's us doing it together. It's you know, I mean, this is the for me, the beauty of doing podcasts and hanging out with people for an hour or so is exactly satsang, sangha, community. And now, of course, most of it happens on Zoom as a result of the pandemic. That will change. Nothing is going to stay the same. But in the moment, it's offering us that opportunity still. And that is entirely key and so important. Even Buddha himself said, right, when Sariputta, I think it was, said, what out of the three refuges, refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, which is the most important, you'd think. Buddha, most people would go. And Buddha himself said, no, Sangha, community. And that's just a huge, gives us a huge leg up if we can just let ourselves partake. And it makes a big difference. It has in my entire life. It's been a central theme. And
we're nothing without each other.
Yeah, we are nothing.
It's really true. And you know, I perhaps this is a good note to close on. Is I really think that there's no way to be happy without a sense of being on a mission in this life. There's no, you know, we all need that. We all crave that, to have a sense of I'm here for a reason.
Purpose.
And I'm on a mission of some sort. And the only mission, and there's a million different ways this could go, but the only mission to be on is one of helping, one of service, one of love, one of spreading compassion, relief, healing in some way. I'm convinced there's just no way to be truly happy unless you cultivate that in your life.
Absolutely. As they say in India, Ram Ram. Bilku. For sure. Bilku.
Yeah,
absolutely.
A little more concise.
Thanks, Ralph. Love
it. Thank you so much.
Our hangouts are just wonderful. Yeah. And everybody out there, of course, all of the references, and including Viktor Frankl, and of course, Don't Tell Me to Relax, and everything will be on the show notes and available, linked up, so you can easily find everything and find Ralph. And again, thank you.
Yeah, so much gratitude to you. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Ralph. Everybody, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling and go to Be Here Now Network on its own. And so many different. Oh, Joseph Campbell, which that was a beginning quote, looks like we are going to have these wonderful talks that were given that include Joseph Campbell from OHI Foundation. And that's going to start up in a month or so. And I can't wait to hear that. I haven't actually heard it. Joseph Campbell. Wow.
That sounds wonderful. About
the hero's journey. Yeah. So we have great things coming up, including Alan Watts, too, who's going to have a podcast on the network. So tune in, and we shall see you next week. Namaste.